Parshas Yisro, we begin with Yisro and Zipporah, the return to Moshe in the desert. And the main story here is that Yisro sees that Moshe is exhausting himself from morning to night. He's handling all the Dinei Torah, all the justice that the Jewish people needs. He tells Moshe, it's too much, you're overtaxing yourself. Novel Tibol, you're going to get wear yourself out. Gamata, Gamha'am. So Moshe says, you know, what can I do? Moshe says, this is what I have to do. He says, people have questions. They come to me. That was before Novel Tibol. They come to me, and I have to be the one to decide. I'm the decider. So Yisro says, all right, we have to delegate. Yisro says, my suggestion is that you set up a system of underlings, of judges who will serve under you. And the key pasuk is, he tells him, Va'ata sechazem ikala'am. Seek out, find, you select from the people, Anshei Chayil, men of valor, Yirei Elokim, God-fearing men, Anshei Emes, men of truth, Sonei Vatza, those who hate money, Samta Alem, you should appoint these men with these wonderful qualities, Sarei Alafim, Sarei Meas, Sarei Chamishim, Sarei Asaros, appoint them as Sarim, masters, men of thousands, men of hundreds, men of 50, men of 10, and these people, they'll handle the basic judging, V'shaftu Esam B'chaleis. They'll take care of all the routine judging. And Bahaya Kala Davara Gadol Yivu Elecha, the routine stuff, the basic stuff that lower level people can handle, they'll take care of. Bahala Davara Katan Yishbatuhem. And they'll do the routine, the smaller things. Vahakel Me'alecha V'nasu Itach. And that'll take some of the burden off you. This was Yisro's great suggestion, and Moshe agreed, and he put it into play. There is a famous statement of Chazal. A little cynical, I guess. It says that even though Yitzhak said we want Anshe Emes, Sonei Vetzah, we want all these qualities, they didn't actually find people with all the qualities. They found some of them. It says in Dvarim they only found people with some of those qualities. It was too hard to find people who were actually superlative in all these areas. In any event, the basic system, it says that Moshe did indeed implement the system. They had Sarei Alafim, Sarei Meos, again, the same phrase, Sarei Chamishim, Sarei Asaros. And again, the Davar HaKasha they brought to Moshe, and the lower level things, they took care of themselves. That's the story at the beginning of Parshas Yisro. What exactly were Sarei Alafim, Sarei Meos, Sarei Chamishim, and Sarei Asaros? Again, literally, the phrase doesn't have an absolutely clear meaning. Literally, it means men, you know, men, masters, nobles, and masters of thousands, masters of hundreds, masters of 50, and masters of 10. What do those mean? What were the differences between those four groups? So the standard pshat, Rashi, Chazal, other Rishonim, the standard pshat, which we learn mostly, I think, is that the men of 10 were in charge. They were of 10 Jews, 10 citizens, where their jurisdiction was 10 Jews. They were like a very local, hyper-local kind of rav, hyper-local dayan. The men of 50 were in charge of larger communities of 50. The men of hundreds were in charge of larger communities of hundreds. And the men of thousands were in charge of thousands. Though the Chazal actually calculate the numbers, there were a total of some 77,000 judges. Because there were 600,000 Jews, so if there was one man in charge, if the Sarei Asaros each had 10 people under them, there would have been 60,000 of those. If the Sarei Chamishim each had 50 under them, there would have been 1/5 as many, another 12,000, and so on and so forth. So there was some 70-something thousand of these judges. But again, we have no sense, according to Rashi, according to Chazal, there's no sense of hierarchy. We just have that there were Dayanim who had different groups of people under them. And there's no real sense, there's no obvious explanation for what the relationship was between a Sar of Eser and a Sar of Chamishim. One had more people under him, one had fewer people under him, but we don't really get any clear explanation of what their different roles were and how they related to each other, except that one of them had a larger group of people under his authority. The Ibn Ezra has perhaps a less well-known shot, but he objects strenuously to this standard shot of Chazal and Rashi. He says there couldn't have been that many people who were trained. They couldn't have had 70,000 plus people. You know, today they talk about how there's a glut of, you know, law graduates. There aren't enough jobs for them. But back then he didn't think that there were so many people who would have been qualified even for the lesser qualifications of Dvarim. They found 70 plus thousand people. Why do they need so many people? Do you really need a dayan for every 10 people? You know, how do they find so many trained people? So the Ibn Ezra has a totally different explanation of the phrases. Again, this is not the mainstream approach, but the Ibn Ezra says, you know, sometimes in business we measure how important somebody is. We say he has 5 direct reports, he has 10 direct reports, He says these were basically how many people reported to them. He says a sar of elef means he had a staff. He was the head of a bureaucracy of 1,000. His na'arim, his shamashim, his enforcers, whatever they were. The sar of the elef was a really important, high level guy. He had 1,000 people who were his apparatus, his machine. The sar of eser had a small staff of 10 people. The sar of chamishim. So these don't refer to the jurisdiction they had over the citizens, but these refer to the size of their bureaucracy, their the people who reported to them in their organization. That's another way to learn. What I want to discuss today is the pshat of the Sfarno. I imagine you might find this in other Mepharshim too, but the one who I always saw says this is the Sfarno. The Sfarno understands that the system being talked about here was basically an appellate system. The modern idea that we have, that there's a trial court, and then there is a court of appeal, and then there's a higher court of appeal, the Supreme Court. The Sfarno learns that the system being described here was essentially an appellate system. He says, he also learns more like Rashi and Chazal, that there were a lot of these lower courts who had smaller jurisdictions, and then the higher courts had larger jurisdictions, just like we have, let's say, 9 federal appellate courts, and more than that, district courts. So he says that there were arba madrega zula mala mizu. There was a hierarchy. Unlike Rashi, who just says there were 4 of different sizes, he emphasizes there was a hierarchy. There was zula mala mizu. So he says, hina yishpara katan, the court of first jurisdiction would rule. But tzoek al psakdino, someone who was not happy, who complained, who was upset about his verdict, yitzok el agadol mimenu, he would appeal to level 2, the sari chamishim. Minasheni al ashlishi. There were 4 levels. If you didn't like, if you still were unhappy after the second level, you would go to the third level. Minashlishi el ravi. Then you would go up to the fourth level. And so on. So by the time you got to the highest level, you'd have the lowest caseload. So everything might get up to Moshe eventually. The Pesukim just say there was Dover Katan and Dover Gadol. There were the small matters would go to the lower court, big matters would go to Moshe. So that you can understand simply means that when cases were important enough, they would go straight to Moshe. Like the Gemara talks about the Sanhedrin, certain matters were reserved for the Sanhedrin. Not everyone would, a regular basin of 3, a local basin, wouldn't make decisions about war, about the Kohen Gadol, about the Melech. But the Sfarno understands it wasn't just a question of the magnitude of the case. It was actually an appeal, that many cases would end up, it would start on the lowest level, and some would wend their way up through an appellate system all the way to Moshe Rabbeinu himself. But just like the Supreme Court, it doesn't have as many cases as the trial courts do, so too, that's how the system worked in the proposal of Yisro implemented by Moshe.
Are the numbers the same as Rashi's plot?
I'm not 100% sure. I think he's explaining roughly the same as Rashi and Chazal, and he's not answering the Benazir's question of why there were so many necessarily, but I think he basically understands the same system, but he adds that it was hierarchical instead of just different types of courts. So that's what I want to talk about today, the question of what is the role in halacha for judicial review, what we call in America, Western countries, judicial review, the idea that there are certain courts whose job it is to review the rulings of other courts and either let them stand or overturn them or send them back or man them for further discussion. Is this a system that exists in halacha? The Sfarno is telling us that was the system of Yisro. What do we find in halacha, in the history of the Jewish people? Was this a system that was used? Is this a system in use today? So I want to clarify this basically from 2 perspectives. First, we have to discuss it historically. What do we know about how the system of Beis Din worked? The Sfarno is a kind of somewhat speculative explanation of the Pesukim, but in terms of actual history, what do we know about how Beis Din worked in the time of Chazal, in the time of the Rishonim, the medieval period, the Achronim, down till today? How did Batei Din actually work? And B, what are the theoretical issues? What are the halachic arguments for or against having an appellate system of Beis Din? Is that legitimate for a Beis Din to review, to second guess the ruling of an earlier Beis Din? So a lot has been written about this, especially the last century or so, last century, century and a half. And that really has to do with the history. So to briefly summarize what I know of the history, in the time of Chazal, we don't really have any evidence, and even the poskim who justify, as we'll get to later, justify an appellate system today, basically concede, time of Chazal, we have no real evidence of any sort of regular, systematic system of appeal. We do have, as we mentioned earlier, we alluded earlier, there were several levels of Batei Din in Chazal. We have Beis Din of 3, it's the smallest Beis Din. We have a Beis Din of 23, we have a Sanhedrin Agadol. But you don't really get the sense from Chazal that there was an appellate process. As I said earlier, the job of the Sanhedrin HaGadol was to handle certain kinds of cases of national significance. It says, you know, the Mishnah, the Rambam list things that need Sanhedrin. You can't declare war without a Sanhedrin. You can't judge a Melech without a Sanhedrin. You can't judge a Kohen Gadol without a Sanhedrin. Ibar Hashana, calendar decisions, basically certain decisions that were of national importance or of major importance for some reason were taken care of in the Sanhedrin. But you don't necessarily get the idea that a major function of the Sanhedrin's role was reviewing the Psakim of Lower Beis Din. Beis Din of 23 also, it wasn't an appellate Beis Din. Beis Din of 23 you need for capital cases, maybe certain other things, but it says in general in Chazal that even when you have three, the more Dayanim you have, as we're learning at night, the better it is. It's better to have more. But basic dini mamonos need only three. Three is enough. Certain cases need 23. Certain cases need Sanhedrin and Gadol. But we don't really get the idea necessarily that there was any kind of regular system of appeal. There are certain statements in Chazal, as we'll discuss a little bit later, which do indicate at least suggest the possibility of appeal. But we don't have that much detail, as we'll discuss later. It's not clear how regular, how systematic this was, although there are certain statements in Chazal, somewhat ambiguous usually, that indicate that at least the possibility of appealing a Beis Din. In the time of the Rishonim also, we don't have, in terms of the poskim, the ones who wrote on Gemara, the ones who established the halacha systematically, we don't really have any discussion of a systematic process of appeal. Again, we have individual psakim, individual statements of the poskim, as we'll discuss later, that do indicate the possibility of appeal in some cases, but again, no real discussion, no regular discussion of an appellate system of how it works. And again, we'll discuss the specific statements of the Rishonim about when review might be legitimate. We'll move to that a little bit later. Same thing in the time of the Achronim. We have this kind of isolated, ad hoc discussion of whether a Beis Din's ruling can ever be appealed. What we do have in the Rishonim and the Achronim is evidence that there were communities that did, as a matter of historical fact, establish some kind of system for reviewing a Beis Din. Not going to get into the details of what these systems were, but the best evidence, or the evidence that I've looked at the most, is in the last century or century and a half, from the late 19th century down through the present, we have a lot of discussion by the late Achronim of various appellate systems and discussions of whether they're legitimate or not, as we'll discuss soon. The main discussion begins in Eretz Yisrael, in what was then Mandatory Palestine, about 1920, when Eretz Yisrael was still under the control of the British. So the British were giving them autonomy, so some level of autonomy. They could police their own, they could run their own affairs. But I don't know the history that well, but the British basically wanted certain westernizations of the system. One of the things they wanted was a system of appeal. They wanted the Batei Din to be subject to some kind of review process. They wanted a dissatisfied litigant to have some way of challenging it. So the British were pressuring the Yishuv to institute some kind of system of review. So there was a great debate about the matter among the Gedolei HaRabbanim of the Yishuv at that time. Many of the more conservative, reactionary Rabbanim were vehemently against it. They felt, as we said, as we've discussed briefly until now, they felt this was not the traditional way of Jewish way of doing things. The Sfarno aside, they felt that in Halacha we have no evidence that there was ever any system, any routine system of appellate courts, and they felt this was an unwarranted imposition of Western ideas onto the Halacha. There were those who supported it, most notably Rav Kook. Rav Kook, as we'll discuss a little bit later, felt it was perfectly legitimate to do for reasons we'll discuss soon. I don't know exactly what happened back then in the 1920s, but certainly when the modern Rabbanut system was established after the state, it was established with an appellate process. They have the Beit Din HaGadol, Beit Din Le'irurim. They do have an appellate system. As some of the posts can point out in justification, many of the first names in Choshen Mishpat, many of the greatest luminaries in the judicial firmament did sit on that Beis Din. People like Rav Yashuv, people like Sitzel Yezer, Rav Avadi Yosef, Rav Waldenberg. Many of the greatest post-Kim in Eretz Yisrael did sit on that Beis Din. And well, today, from what I understand, in Israel, we have basically three tracks, three systems of justice that are, for our purposes, so to speak. We have, obviously, the secular Israeli courts, which are modern, which are patterned on a Western model, you know, modern of law. You know, those don't interest us particularly here. They obviously do have an appellate system, but that's not our affair. We have the Batei Din of the Rabbanut, which again, certainly in the early days, and even today, are staffed by many of the leading figures there, are first-rate poskim, first-rate dayanim. And they do have, again, they do have an appellate system. They have the Beit Din Le'irurim, which is basically an appellate Beis Din. that reviews, again, purely from a halachic perspective, it reviews verdicts of lower Batei Din. Then there are the private Batei Din, the same way we have in the United States. We have private Batei Din that function as arbitration panels. Haredim have a lot of them in Bnei Brak, you know, in Yerushalayim. And they function much as they do in the U.S. And the system in the U.S. also, the Batei Din here in the U.S., we have no formal appellate process. You know, there's no standard rule that if I go to Beis Din X and I don't like their psak, there's no obvious route for challenging the ruling of the Beis Din. Many Batei Din do have an internal process by which they allow you to appeal. For example, the Beis Din of Arvad, the Rabbinical Council of Greater Washington, does have an internal appellate process. If you are unsatisfied with the litigant, is unsatisfied with the verdict, he appeals to it's very internal, it's really the same dayanim, but you appeal to the actual panel that heard your case. They decide whether there's grounds for a expanded hearing. If there is grounds for an expanded hearing in their judgment, they're the ones who decide. But if there is, then the case is reheard, or there's a session in front of an expanded panel of the original three dayanim plus two additional dayanim. Beis Din of America, the RCA Beis Din, also has an internal process. Their process, I think, that if your case has been heard in front of three of their dayanim of the Beis Din of America, so then you, if you don't like it, you get to present the case, I think, before Rav Willig or a Schechter, and they decide whether any further action is necessary. So, but again, many Batei Din have their own process defined by their rules and procedures. But there isn't any kind of systematic overall thing where if I don't like Pesach Beis Din X, I can go to Beis Din Y, who's a higher Beis Din, who has authority. Now, what any given Beis Din will do if you approach a Beis Din and say, you're Beis Din Y, I already appeared before Beis Din X, I'm not happy with the ruling, can you please take a look and tell me what you think? What the Beis Din will do varies from Beis Din to Beis Din. Some Batei Din will tell you, you know, not interested, if it's already been handled by a competent tribunal, we're not mixing in. Other Batei Din do feel it's their right or prerogative duty to take a look and let you know what they think. Again, we'll discuss the halachic basis for why they would or wouldn't do that soon. But again, in the private Beis Din system, there is no well-established systematic procedure. It's basically every Beis Din has its own policies. In Israel, in the Rabbanut system, there is a Beis Din Leirurim. Historically, we have little evidence of there being such a system operational in the Batei Din of the Jewish people. So in order to understand what the issues are, what the arguments for or against, let's discuss now, again, going back from the Gemara down through the Rishonim and Acharonim to understand what the issues are, why it would or would not be appropriate for a Beis Din to review the steps taken by an earlier Beis Din. So in the Gemara, there's, again, very, very little directly on point. There is one line in the Gemara in Bava Basra in a fairly obscure, fairly ambiguous context, which is widely quoted by all the poskim, although, again, it's very difficult to know exactly what the Gemara means. The Gemara uses the expression Beidina Basar Beidina Lo Daiki. One Beis Din does not second guess, does not challenge, does not reopen a decision taken by an earlier Beis Din. Now, first of all, it's not even clear if the Gemara means they're not allowed to. They generally don't. It's a professional courtesy. They don't bother to. It's not worth their time. The Gemara makes the kind of factual, descriptive statement that they don't do it. Not even clear that it's prescriptive at all. The context of the Gemara, as I said, is fairly obscure. Basically, it's a warning. The Gemara is using it, at least the way the Rashbam explains, it's a warning to the first Beis Din to make sure they do everything right. Don't rely on the second Beis Din when they see your document to check and make sure all the evidence was presented properly. They're going to rely on you. So you make sure that you did all the legwork before issuing a ruling, because they may rely on you. Again, there's no azhara, there's no injunction directed to the second Beis Din. Don't do that. The injunction is directed to the first Beis Din. Make sure you do things thoroughly, because the second Beis Din won't be rechecking your work. So there are some contemporary posts who suggest, as I just said, the Gemara never meant this as an isser, as a normative statement to the second Beis Din not to do that. But nevertheless, in spite of that, this Gemara has been understood by most poskim to be actually an injunction against the second Beis Din. It is not proper. They are not supposed to be checking the work of an earlier Beis Din. And this is generally the attitude we find in the Rishonim. Again, in spite of the fact that the Rishonim also, they don't always phrase it in terms of Isser v'Heter, but they kind of take for granted that whether they're making a political statement, why would I get involved, it's not worth it. But the Rishonim, typically, we have a number of different tshuvas and statements where Rishonim say things like, how can you ask me to get involved? Someone already handled your case, and why are you bringing this to me? We have a tshuva in the Rush Someone asked the Rosh a question. The Rosh says, Lo yadati lama sheltuni al zeh. I don't know why you're asking me this. I saw in your letter, I saw in your written presentation of the case that you already had dayanim. They heard your claims. They passed him to din. So the Rosh says, if there already was a din, why are you asking me for another psak? He brings the Gemara, Beidina bas Beidina lo daiki. Why would I second guess an earlier Beis Din? Lo yitachinli, I can't do it, he says. It's not possible. Lo yitachinli lifsok psak acher al din shepasku kvar anashim gedolim v'nechbad. I can't paskin on a case that was already handled by great, serious dayanim. Now, the Rosh does use the language of gedolim v'nechbadim. I'm not going to reopen the case because it was already handled by great and honorable men. There is some discussion in the later Achronim, 300 years later, whether the Rosh's statement was limited to the case where there were esteemed and illustrious dayanim. The consensus of Achronim, at least as I understand it, is it does not make a difference. The Rosh said that to kind of magnify the inappropriateness of it. But the Rosh meant simply, once it's been handled by competent dayanim, that's it, regardless of whether the Gedolei Hadar or not. If it's been handled by people who are competent and legitimate dayanim, I have no business reopening the case. And we find similar things in other Rishonim. We have a tshuva of the Ran. The Ran, apparently, as often happens, people who go to a Rav don't always tell him everything that's been happening beforehand. They don't always give him the whole story. So the Ran apparently was caught. Someone brought him a case and didn't disclose that there had been some involvement of other Rabbanim. You can use your imagination. Not hard to visualize this happening. So the Ran apologized to the other Dayanim. He apparently issued some ruling. He apologized to the other Dayanim. He said, the first thing I want to say is, I apologize, ani misnatzel lefnei kvodchem, that I answered the question. Lo yadati, I didn't know that you ruled already, he says. Had I known that you ruled, I would have said, karhoru zekeinim mumchem mufakim. Again, he uses the language that were great men, but most the Achronim say it doesn't really make a difference. I would have told them, take a hike, your case has already been heard by expert dayanim. Hatoyin achron maisa based in lo amar klum. Someone who tries to complain and protest an act of Beis Din is we pay no attention to that. Meister, they didn't tell me. So my ruling was issued inadvertently. He says I wasn't aware there was already some judicial activity around the psak. We actually do find some direct halachic statements aside from cases, actual cases. We do find actual halachic rulings also of Rishonim, who generally also take the position that it's not appropriate, that it's usur for a Beis Din to second-guess an earlier Beis Din. One of the most widely quoted is in the Sefer Chazei HaTnufa, the collection of Tshuvas of the Rishonim, the Rosh, and others, where the Chazei HaTnufa says, Reuven and Shimon, two litigants, came to a Din Torah. One of them won. The loser wasn't content, so he sent out a summons from another Beis Din to reappear, to re-adjudicate the case. So the Chazei HaTnufa says, Eino zakuk le'eridim uladin. The one who won the first time doesn't have to submit to this kind of double jeopardy, doesn't have to do that. Lo lahash v'altanosev, doesn't have to respond, doesn't have to answer, doesn't have to engage in any further discussion. V'gam, and furthermore, he says, Ein ha-beistin ha-sheni rashoi l'shma advar of klal. So first of all, you the litigant don't have to cooperate. The second beistin has no business listening. Once the first guy won. Svara, that's mustaver. The Achronim commonly understood that there are actually two different problems going on here, two different reasons why the second Beis Din has no business reopening a case that was handled by the first Beis Din. One of them is simple fairness. Simple, you can't litigate everything forever. L'shafkis chai l'chol beria. It's not fair to the first litigant once he won that he should have to endlessly re-argue the case. At some point, there's finality. The Beis Din paskins and that's it. The other issue is kavod of the first Beis Din. It's considered disrespectful. It's considered a slap in the face, a chutzpah, a bizayon for the first Beis Din to not give them credit, to not assume that they know what they're doing. To reopen the case implies that you don't have any confidence in their ability to paskin. That's considered a bizayon for the first Beis Din. It's a very similar halacha in Hilchos Nida, in your day in general. The Gemara says that if one Rav issues a ruling of Isser, and another Rav wants to, and the question is presented to another Rav who would like to issue a ruling of Heter, you're not allowed to. The Gemara says, Chacham Shahara, Chacham Shahasar, Ein Chacham Acher Rashai LaHatir. Once one Rav has prohibited something, another Rav is not permitted to permit it. Again, the post can give different reasons. One of the reasons, again, is covered for the Rav. There are other reasons there, too. But in the Chashon Mishpat context, many Achronim assume that there are two different reasons in play. Both are valid. One reason is it's disrespectful to the first Beis Din to not give them the benefit of the doubt that they were correct. The other reason is it's not fair to the litigant, and it's not practical to run a judicial system like that where cases have to be reheard and relitigated endlessly. That's just not fair. There has to be some finality, and that's why second base should inherit. The first party doesn't have to cooperate. And that is basically the consensus of the Achronim. The Beis Yosef, for example, the Beis Yosef brings the language of one of the Rishonim, who says that the rush, that once Basin has ruled, even if both litigants want to reopen the case and have it reheard, why they would do that, I don't know. Why the winner would ever want to rehear it, I don't know. Maybe it was a pshara, they both won halfway, they both want to reopen it, each one hopes he'll do better on the second round. Even if both parties want to rehear the case, you can't do it. So the Beis Yosef says, why on earth would that be? If they don't mind, you know, who's stopping them? Beis Yosef says, yes, we do stop them, because even if they both want to do it, it's disrespectful to the first Basin. For them to set aside the verdict and reopen it, That's just not fair. It's not right. It's not respectful to the first Basin. And again, this is the more or less the consensus of Rishonim and to some extent Achronim too. Now, when we get to the Achronim, it's not quite as clear as I've made it sound, because as we noted earlier, the primary reason, the primary basis for the idea that Basin doesn't check the work of another Basin is the Gemara that says Beidina Basa Beidina Lo Daiki. A Basin does not review, does not second guess the decision of an earlier Basin. And whether the issue is covered or fairness or whatever it is, the basic assumption is that the first Basin probably knew what they were doing. We have the right to assume that the first Basin is competent and knows what it's doing. And the problem is, as we say in all areas of halacha and Chashon Mishpat and halacha in general, We always have a presumption of Yiridus Hadoros, of the idea that we are no longer as competent. We're learning Hilchos Deonim at night now, and you find all the time, even though Chazal talk about Mumcha and this and that, we always say we don't have Mumcha, we don't have this, we're not sure we know how to do Din anyway. There's a general sense, you know, all over Yeridea, all over the Torah, that we are simply not as great scholars, we're not as competent, we're not as good as the Batei Din of the Rabbanim of earlier generations were. So the question arises, maybe it's true in the time of the Talmud, in the time of the Rishonim, a second Basin wouldn't second guess an earlier Basin because the earlier Basin knew what they were doing because they knew how to paskin din. Maybe today, we simply aren't as good, we aren't as skilled, we aren't as knowledgeable as we used to be. Maybe today we should second guess because maybe today we can't really afford to give the early Basin the benefit of the doubt. This svara was proposed by the Radvaz in the 16th century. The Radvaz writes, even though the Talmud says lo cheshinu based in toim, we don't consider the possibility of a based in that erred, and we say lo daiki, we don't second guess their work. Says the Radvaz, hani mili bizmaneim. That was true back then, where they were much better than we were. Aval ha'idna daikina v'daikina. Today we definitely should second guess an earlier based in ha'idna lo biki kol kach bedinim. Today we're not so expert. Hilkach, we are daikinan, and even in the time of the Rishonim, he says that was true. He's medayik this from various Rishonim. Certainly 300 years later, in the 16th century, he says, certainly today, we are medayik, we do have to review, we should review, we can review the earlier Basin. And that's the position of the Radvaz. The Radvaz, though, you know, was challenged by the Beis Yosef himself. Beis Yosef in a tshuva in the Afkas Rochel, in his tshuvas, he vigorously disagreed with the Radvaz. The Radvaz is wrong, he says, or the Radvaz misunderstood the sources in the Rishonim he was quoting. He says, the Rashba was talking about a specific case where the Psak looks very strange. The Psak, prima facie, seems wrong, seems bizarre. If there's some reason, if there's some reason to believe the Psak sounds strange, then in those specific circumstances, you have the right to second guess. In an ordinary din where there's nothing that leads us to believe the first baseman made a mistake, Gam bizman hazeh lo daiki, it's pashut, he says, and that is the position of the Beis Yosef. Now, throughout the Achronim, for the next several hundred years, particularly in the Sfarim of the Sfardim, we find some debate over whose opinion it dominates, whose opinion should we follow, the Radvaz or the Beis Yosef. Many Achronim say that the Radvaz is a Das Yachid, the Beis Yosef Shita is Iker, that even Bizman Hazeh we say Lo Daiki. The Radvaz is not totally a Das Yachid. There is a Tshuva of the Mabit, another contemporary of the Radvaz and the Beis Yosef. Mabit also brings a view that today we're not Bekiyim and Yesh Lachush, and the third Sefer, the Maisachia. So there are several early Achronim who take the position of Radvaz that today we do second guess because today we're not so bucky. And Lamai said there are many Achronim who disagree. Many Achronim say that the Beis Yosef's opinion is, Maran's opinion is normative, and we follow Maran, and we don't second guess. So throughout the Achronim, we find later Achronim, particularly Svardim, going back and forth on this question of whether we say, Beidina Basa Beidina is Daiki Bizman Hazeh, is not Daiki Bizman Hazeh. Rav Chaim Pelagi says Radvaz is not a, in the 19th century, he says Radvaz is not a Yachid. He might not be the majority, he might not be totally the majority, but he's not a Yachid either. He says there are several other Akronim who say the same position. So the Akronim go back and forth as to whether the position of the Beis Yosef is normative or the position of the Radvaz is a legitimate view.
So there's an obvious, logical problem with the Radvaz, right? That everybody should have gone down simultaneously, right? So why is it, so even if we're not as great as the previous generations,
why is the second
base board any better than the first?
Why don't you just say relative? At the end of the day, it's still, you're no better than him. So why would you? It's a good point. Yeah, that's a good point. I guess the idea is that if people are presumed competent, then one decision is enough. If people are not competent, then I guess the more people you ask, I guess we hope that if we can't rely on any one base, what do you do if the two buddies didn't disagree? That's, I think, the corollary of your question. So let's say you do review it. Let's say they come out with a different opinion. So why should I believe the second basin more than the first basin? If the first basin thought one way, the second basin thinks another way, the first basin is not as good as it used to be, neither is the second basin. So where do you draw the line? You go to a third basin, go to a fifth basin. How do you ever make somebody pay? We'll just keep on going to more and more Bate Din. The question becomes, at what point do you stop? At what point do you get some kind of authoritative opinion? These are all good questions, and I'm not fully prepared with an answer. We'll discuss this a little bit further, but that is a good question, which I don't really have a satisfactory answer for that. But we'll discuss it a little bit more as we go. Sorry?
How is Rabim and Yachid defined in these cases? Is it a numbers game? Like, they're more post control this way or that?
So then that's a question in Psak in general, all over Psak, and Chash Mishpat in particular. There are many post-game who do take Yachid and Rabim very, very literally. There's a very entertaining tshuva of Rav Chaim Ben Venisti, the Knesset Gdola. At one point, he's taking what is often considered the more Sephardic approach of actually counting how many authorities are on each side. So in one particular issue, I don't even remember what it was, in one particular issue, he counts up and he says, so we have six opinions one way, we showed them, and we have five the other way. He says, wait a second, but of those five I listed, one of them was Yesh Omrim, so that's plural, so that counts for at least two. He says, but when I listed the other list, one of them said Rabosai, so the Rabosai is also plural, so that's two. So instead of six against five, it's seven against six. So there are those who take that very, very literally. The Chazon Ish, I believe, I don't have the quote in front of me, the Chazon Ish, I think, was very unhappy with this approach. He said that we simply don't have all the opinions. Even if you found five Rishonim one way and six the other way, there were hundreds of scholars in the medieval period, and many of them didn't leave us anything in writing. So you can argue statistically, do we have a large enough sample to assert with any confidence that based on our sample we have the majority, but usually we don't. And just because you found three Rishonim one way and two the other way, that's five out of 500, which is not statistically, I assume that's not statistically very useful. So the Chazon Ish felt that since you don't have the complete tally, even if you would theoretically go bust or a strict rove, It's not realistic. In an actual Beis Din, everyone agrees you do follow strict rove. In a Beis Din of 23, you follow 12 against 11, not for Dina Nefashos, where there's a special rule that to convict you need two more than for the guilty side than the innocent side, but for innocence you follow 12 and 11. So in an actual Beis Din, a Beis Din of 3, you follow 2 against 1. It's a Sanhedrin. In actual Beis Din, you do follow rove. In poskim, as I said, it's kind of split. The Sfardim tended to adopt a more numerical approach, Ashkenazim much less so. And these types of questions of Psak, or if you went to multiple Bate Din, again, that's what Dr. Edinger was asking also. I don't know exactly how you would do it. But again, Rav Avadia also is famous for adopting a much more numerical approach of literally, amassing lists of names and poskim. He doesn't calculate purely arithmetically, but he does attempt to find what most poskim say. Ashkenazim, much less so. And again, it's an important question, but difficult to answer, and I don't have the sources on my fingertips, really.
How did the Mechaber do it, if there's time?
So the Mechaber has a unique system. The Mechaber famously explained in the introduction to his Beis Yosef that he picked three poskim we felt were extremely authoritative. They were the Rif, the Rambam, and the Rush. And he then said that typically, if they're unanimous, he typically followed their ruling. If they're not unanimous, he typically followed two out of three. There are exceptions, like anything else, but the Rambam does, the Beis Yosef does fairly consistently follow that rule. Explicitly, sometimes he tells you, V'kiva unto harash, v'rambam maskim l'dea echas, hachi nachtinan. And when he doesn't, he's often challenged for why isn't he following his rule. So why he picked these three exactly is less clear. But he picked these three. We find in other communities they picked other groups. So, for example, the Chidah records a tradition that, for Sfardim, he says the Marashdam, the Marashach, I think, and Rabbi Mari ben Lev are considered for us the three Amudei Haorah, three of the great early Sfardic Achronim. So, yeah, it's a big topic, and it requires further discussion of who your universe of poskim is and how you count them. But in general, yes, it's an important question, but not going to be able to get too much further into it today. We can talk about it more later if you want. So, one other, before getting to the discussions of the modern poskim for how they deal with appellate systems, one other basis in halakha for appealing comes from a well-known but not so always so well-understood halakha called Kisvuli Me'ezatam Dantuni. The Gemara says, the Shulchan Aruch paskins, that in certain cases, the loser of a Din Torah has the right to ask the Beis Din, please put the verdict, please put the transcript, some debate exactly what, but please put things into writing, please give me an official written verdict. Now, we might take this for granted. In a Western system, we take for granted that when you go to court, you're entitled to some kind of published ruling. Halacha does not really have that attitude, and many more traditional Batei Din do not put things in writing or put very, very little in writing. The Batei Din I've worked with, for example, often put just the barest outline of the case, like the matter of the house on 123 Main Street that came before us. We have heard both sides, and we rule house belongs to the plaintiff. Like, that's it. Certainly not enough to reconstruct the case, enough to tell them what we expect them to do, but not enough to give any kind of understanding of what the case was. Certainly not enough for anyone to reconstruct the case and reissue a ruling. So there is a halakha that in certain cases, litigants have the right to say, Kisvuli Me'ezatam Dantuni, I do want either the reasons or a transcript. And it's clear from the poskim, Rishonim, certainly Achronim, the reason you're allowed to ask that, at least in certain cases, is because you want the possibility of having a second Beis Din check the work of the first Beis Din. For example, some poskim say, you don't even need the reasoning. This sounds very strange to us, and I have to admit, I don't fully understand this, but they say you don't even need the reasoning. As long as you have a transcript of the claims and the evidence presented, that's all you need. Take it to a second base and let them decide whether it was right. Why do they need to see what your analysis was? If the analysis was right, they'll discover it on their own. If it was wrong, then it's wrong. They don't even need to see why you reasoned what you reasoned. All they need to know is what exactly took place, and they can then reconstruct and see if they come to the same decision. But the point is that the evidence is very clearly there, that there is, at least in some cases, possibility of taking the transcript of a case from a first Beis Din, taking it to another Beis Din, and checking if they got it right or not. Policy. Policy and tradition. The Beis Din I worked with did not want to do it as a matter of policy. They felt that the more information given to the litigants, the more trouble they were likely to make, they would start. The more they were able to disagree and challenge and in general give us a hard time, they did not like to do it. I was never happy with the policy. I felt that it was more professional, more serious to give to go out on a limb maybe, but to give more information. It's a long debate. We can discuss it another time. But the halakha itself, when you're entitled to get it and when not, the rules are complicated. And we specifically asked the litigants who came before us in advance of the case, please waive any right you have to ask us for reasoning, because we don't want to get involved in that in details. But It's a good question. We can talk about it more later.
If you get a chance to go to the second Beis Din, do you have to bring the same witnesses, the same people, or do you come up with a whole new case, bring 100 new people to testify?
So again, in the traditional system, as discussed by the postkim, there's very little guidance about that. As I said, there's no real discussion of a systematic approach to this, and we don't have any real rules or any real... In the modern system, which I'll discuss now, there are rules, as we'll discuss in a moment. It's more limited and follows more the Western model of an appellate process. In the traditional system, again, there was no system. It was just a question of individual tshuvas, and it's very hard to reconstruct what they would have allowed, what they didn't allow. But we'll discuss now what the modern system was, and I'll give one specific example, which I always found intriguing, of what is allowed or not allowed, at least according to some opinions. So the modern system, as I said, begins about 1920. There's actually one major tshuva which precedes that. There's a tshuva of a Rabbi Pipano in 1912, Tafayin Reish Beis, in Sofia, in Bulgaria. The system there they had, the Jewish community had established one of these appellate processes, and the system apparently was operational. Somebody was hauled into Beis Din and lost, and appealed, and the appellate Beis Din sent out a hazmana, a summons for the both litigants to appear for an appellate hearing. The guy who won wasn't interested, He challenged the entire legitimacy of the system. He said, Al pi halacha, bey din bas bedin lo daiki. We don't second guess bate din. I understand we have an established procedure here, but I think it's not legitimate and I don't accept it. Then I challenge the entire, the whole system is unconstitutional, so to speak. I want the whole system thrown out. So the Choshen HaEfod, he has a lengthy discussion of, very good discussion of this whole sugya of challenging a beis din. His conclusion is that even though Al-Pidin, after several pages of reasoning, he says Al-Pidin, the arguments against the legitimacy of the system are powerful, that we don't second-guess Batidin, like Maran says, like the Beis Yosef says, we even Bizman Azeh, we don't challenge Beis Din. However, he says, that's all true. That's all true Meikra Din. But, he says, particularly in civil cases, in Choshen Mishpat, where the golden rule always is, where the prime directive, so to speak, of Choshen Mishpat always is that we have the idea of takana and minhag. Community, individuals, a community have the right to set up whatever system they want and bind themselves to it. The local community has the right to establish any system they want, in spite of it not being consistent with the traditional halachic system. And all bets are off. All problems are off. There's no chesaron in covered because anyone who becomes a dayan under the system buys into it and understands that he might be second-guessed. It's not considered rude. It's just the way the system works. There's no question of unfairness. The process is limited. The process is well-defined. And he says, Mikra Din, you're right. The system is not historical. It's not legitimate. But the community has the right to do whatever they want. And if they've done this, that's what they have the right to do. And this is the main justification for the modern appellate system in Israel. This was proposed by, as I said, a number of Gedolei HaPoskim. For example, Rav Kook. Rav Kook, when he said that, when he was asked to discuss one of his letters about an appellate beis din, he wrote, I think it's a good idea, dati nota shechayavim anu, to establish such a system. It should be a takana. I'm not saying it's mikra din, it's a takana. Kachol takanas, gedolei hadaros, tzarech hazman. Gedolei hadaros historically have always established rules of the road, in Choshen Mishpat in particular, based on what they think society needs. And we can do it too. So we should make a takana to do this. So b'kitzur, the same idea as the Choshen HaEfod, that mikra din, maybe not. But a takana we have the right to do. In a tshuva of Rav Uziel, in the Mishpatei Uziel, he also defends the system very much, largely mikach takana. And he, in a remarkable tshuva, he goes so far as to basically admit that it's a Western importation, it's a non-Jewish innovation, which was not the traditional Jewish view. You would think, once he concedes that it's non-Jewish, he might start fussing about Chukas HaGoyim or about Darchei Amari, but he thinks it's a great idea, even though it's borrowed from the non-Jews. Im ha'am darish, if the nation wants it, or if we need it, he says, he describes it as, poetically, lahachnis yififuso shel yefes ba'ale shem, to bring in the beauty of yefes into the ale shem. Ale shem is the Jewish tradition, the Beis Medrash, Torah. Yafuso shel yefes is the beauty of yefes, the beauty of Greek culture, of Western culture, of modern civilization. So if we need to bring in some non-Jewish ideas, we can do it. We can make a takana that is fine. Rav Avadia also defends it largely based on takana. He says, even though there are objections, ein davar zeh nakime irurim, there are objections to this, a kind of pun, a play on words. Based on irurim, it's not quite nakime irurim, there are objections to it. He says, l'maiser, if Cook allowed it, he said, and we have the right to make a takana, we have the right to do it in spite of the fact that it's not quite in line with the earlier Batei Din. He has other reasons why it's allowed. Tzitz Eliezer too, Rav Waldenberg, he also argued that this was justified. He makes the kind of sharp point. He says, the minhag is we do it, he says, everyone participates, he says, even the Charedim HaKitzoniim biyoter, even the most extreme Charedim, have no problem participating in the system and going to such Batei Din. So the minhag clearly is to accept it. And again, the primary basis the poskim all have is based on takana. Rav Avadia makes the point that you were making before. He says, even though the poskim say you can't do it, he says, "Hainu besider tainas mechadash." That would be to relitigate, to reopen the case from scratch. That you can't do, he says. But to simply review the written formal verdict of the first beis din to see if it's correct, which is the way I think a modern appellate system works. You don't relitigate, you don't bring new evidence, you just rule based on what you have from the trial court and see if it's correct. That, he says, is allowed, mashmi without a takana. There was an interesting article I once read by Rabbi J. David Bleich. He talks about a case where it was actually a personal status case, an Isser for Kahuna, I think. He talks about a case where a lower beis din ruled one way. I think they allowed something, and then somehow the case was appealed, and I'm not sure who appealed it, but the higher basin overturned it. And Reb Bleich felt that was wrong. First of all, he said, the main justification, Reb Bleich has written extensively about this topic, the main justification, he says, for the appellate review is Choshen Mishpat, that the community can sack him whatever they want. Isser V'Hetter, he says, there's no takanas. Isser V'Hetter, it is what it is. It's not Choshen Mishpat. So the whole idea of an appellate system doesn't belong in Isser V'Hetter, he says. And even if it does, he says, in his particular case, what happened was there was no procedural flaw in the first basin. It happened to be it was a disputed issue, and the dayan on the higher basin had a different opinion than the dayan on the lower basin, he says. That's not grounds for appeal. He says, you disagree? That's not an appeal. Appeal has to be they did something wrong. They overlooked something. They made a procedural error. Just because you have an honest difference of opinion, he says, that's not grounds for an appeal. The appellate system is limited to finding a mistake or finding something wrong, and you can't just decide, I don't agree, so I'm the second basin, I'm just going to change our minds. It's not hefker. There has to be some kind of process, and if Bleich fails, that was overstepping the bounds of the legitimate process.